She started singing again. The satchel. Julia's book. Where is it? Where's my bag? The woman held up the satchel. Right here. It's right here, see? You've nothing to worry about. You're safe here.
Nobody's safe.
A voice grunted. The angry flutes whistled outside, followed by a thunderous roar, and again the room shook. From somewhere behind Emmy, an old man began to recite the 23rd Psalm. The woman who held the compress to her head joined him. A few others did, too.
I'm thirsty, Emmy whispered.
The woman reached behind her for a glass jar and poured water into a tin cup, which she held to Emmy's lips. The water tasted like metal. Emmy lay back down. The woman unwound the shawl she had over her shoulders and folded it into a tight rectangle. Then she placed it under Emmy's head.
Rest now, she said.
Emmy slept. When she awoke, the room was in semi-darkness and cloaked in an odd silence after so much noise hours before. People were walking about slowly, gingerly. Those who hadn't had a cot on which to sleep moved stiffly after having spent the night on the hard floor. Emmy rose to a sitting position, her head protesting. She reached up to touch her forehead and felt a band of gauze, sticky with dried blood. The woman who had ministered to her the night before was asleep on the floor.
Is it over?
Someone asked.
Who knows?
Someone answered.
Who knows anything?
Emmy reached for her satchel at the woman's feet and got up carefully, holding her head as she stood. A wave of dizziness nearly sent her toppling back to the cot. A man walking past steadied her, and Emmy whispered her gratitude. She wanted to thank the woman who had cared for her, but she had to get home to Mum and Julia. Perhaps she would see the woman again someday. Perhaps. Emmy slid the strap of the satchel over her shoulder and tested her footing. Her left ankle ached ferociously. She tried out a few small steps as she followed those also wanting to exit the shelter. They went down a hallway, through a set of double doors, and to a stairway that led upward. Emmy took the steps one at a time, with a hand firmly on the rail. With each step, the smell of ash and fire and dust became more pervasive. The light at the top of the stairs was a sickly yellow, not from the morning sun, but from a thousand fires still burning. St. Paul's appeared undamaged, but as Emmy gingerly made her way east toward home, the destruction from the day before began to reveal itself. Crushed buildings, broken windows, blackened brick, roofs missing or caved in. Fire and rescue crews were rushing about with 100 tasks to attend to. They had no time to bother with a 15-year-old girl who hobbled resolutely down debris-choked streets. The closer Emmy got to the flat, the more her heart began to pound. She passed the intersection that would take her to Primrose. She didn't know whether Mrs. Crofton's shop still stood, but she could not take the time now to see. Her only aim was to make sure Julia and Mum were all right. Emmy passed a rescue crew digging in wreckage. A dead man lay at their feet, his eyes open and vacant, his nose and mouth covered with dried blood. Another man was being tended to. His shoes had been blown off and his shattered legs hung from his pant legs, like laundry on the line.
"Where's my Lucy?"
he was saying. Two more rescue workers were pushing away rubble to get at an outstretched hand.
"Hold on, we're coming for you,"
one of the workers said. He reached for the hand to assure the trapped person that help was on the way. The hand and half of its severed arm tumbled toward him at his touch. Emmy turned away to vomit into the gutter. The paltry contents of her stomach landed on a baby's crib toy. She wheeled away from the scene, holding a hand over her mouth and willing herself to look at nothing but her feet. Finally, She turned down her street. The first few buildings were fine. But then she could see that the row of flats across the street from where she lived had been flattened, squashed as if they'd been made of cardboard. With relief, she saw that the flats on her side of the street still stood. But the explosions from across the street had taken out every front window. Whole sections of roof were missing, and Thea's front door hung by one hinge. Emmy hobbled up to her front door and felt for the key under the mat. She wrenched open the door, calling Mum and Julia's names. Glass and ash covered the sitting room floor. She limped into the kitchen. More broken glass. She turned to hobble up the stairs.
Mum! Julia!
Emmy threw open Mum's bedroom door. Debris littered her bed. The blackout curtains from her window overlooking the street hung in tattered threads. She limped into Julia's room, where she met the same scene.
They weren't there.
Emmy's head throbbed. She made her way back downstairs and pulled out a kitchen chair. She sank into it to wait for them to return from the shelter. She had eaten nothing in nearly 24 hours, and she marveled that her stomach could growl for food after what she had seen that morning. But she was too tired to see whether there was anything edible left. There was no electricity. Whatever was still in the fridge was probably spoiled. She leaned forward to rest her head on the table. Emmy startled awake when she heard a voice outside on the front step.
Bloody mess this is. Mum. Thank God.
Emmy shot up out of the chair and had to steady herself when her injuries protested.
Mum!
She called out. Emmy stumbled into the front room as Mum stepped inside the flat. She staggered toward her mother and wrapped her arms around Mum's neck. Tears that she'd kept at bay since the sirens first sounded yesterday fell freely.
Good Lord, Emmy!
Mum's hand stroked Emmy's hair. She couldn't remember the last time Mum had done that.
Oh, Mum, I was so worried. What in the world? What happened to you? Why are you here?
Mum did not sound angry. She sounded surprised. Completely surprised. Emmy pulled back from her to study her mother's face.
Didn't you see my note? Didn't Julia tell you?
What note?
Didn't Julia tell me what? What are you talking about? Why are you here?
Mum, didn't you come home yesterday? You got off at 4 o'clock.
How did you... Why aren't you in Gloucestershire? Why are you here?
Mum's voice rose in pitch as she slowly realized that something was terribly wrong.
Tell me you came home when you got off work. Tell me you have Julia.
Emmy murmured, new tears already falling. Mum went white.
Julia is with you, in Gloucestershire.
Nausea rose up inside Emmy.
Where did you go?
She whispered.
Em, where is your sister?
Mum's voice trembled.
Where is she? Why didn't you come home?
Emmy cried.
You were supposed to come home!
Mum placed her hands on Emmy's shoulders. Her nails dug into Emmy's skin.
Where is your sister?
Thea. Emmy freed herself from Mum's grasp and limped past her. She staggered across the rubble in between the two flats and swung open Thea's damaged front door. The destruction to Thea's flat was worse than theirs. In addition to broken glass and missing roof sections, the far wall was cracked and bulging inward. But the most disturbing detail was that her furniture was covered in white sheeting. The look of a place that had been sealed up and emptied of its people.
Julia!
Emmy called.
Julia!
Mum was now standing at Thea's doorstep.
What is going on? What did you do?
Emmy wheeled around to face her mother.
Where's Thea? What did you do?
Mum yelled,
You were supposed to come home, Emmy yelled back. What have you done with my baby?
Mum screamed.
Are you two all right?
The two women turned to the voice. A man stood on the sidewalk. Emmy recognized him as the pensioner who lived three doors down. He was staring at them, wide-eyed. Emmy shuffled over to him.
Did you see Julia, my sister? Did you see her here last night?
The man stared at her.
I thought all the children on this street had been evacuated. Did you see her?
Emmy shouted.
No. No, it didn't.
Mum was at Emmy's side.
Emmy, I need to know what happened.
Emmy ignored her.
Did you see Thea, the lady who lives here? Did you see her?
The man blinked.
She and her mum left for Wales. A few days ago, I think.
Did you go to the shelter last night? Did you see a little girl? She's only 7.
Sobs garbled Emmy's words. The man shook his head.
There were no children in the shelter last night, other than a new mother with an infant who came in off the street.
Emmy pushed past him, calling Julia's name.
Should I get a policeman?
The man yelled. But Emmy could not answer him. She could only shout one word.
Julia!
Mum trailed after her, repeating a four-word phrase. Four words that fell at Emmy's back like a mallet.
What have you done?
Chapter 20. There had been a time, right up until the Blitz had begun, when a missing child would have sent policemen scurrying to help. Neighbors and strangers alike would have stopped whatever they were doing to assist in the search. The moment a frantic parent or sibling sounded the alarm, caring strangers dropped everything to search nearby alleys and behind hedges, and they'd ask passers-by whether they'd seen the child. It mattered when a child went missing. But on that Sunday morning, when fire still burned and the dead were still being carried out, and the extent of the destruction still could not be fathomed, a missing 7-year-old was just another calamity in a collection of calamities the likes of which no one had seen before. The police station where Emmy and her mother began their agonized search for Julia was filled with people who wanted information on the whereabouts of loved ones whose houses had been destroyed. An hour passed before a policeman took down their information. Emmy was asked twice why she had left Julia alone.
I had an appointment, she said, and I thought my mother would come home after she got off work.
And why didn't you come home then?
The cop said to Mum.
I had an appointment too,
Mum said, not taking her eyes off the policeman. And I had already placed my children in the care of a foster mother who lives 2 hours away in Gloucestershire, so naturally there was no reason for me to think I was needed at home. Now was there? The cop shook his head, silently indicting them both for such a cavalier approach to responsibility.
All right then, he said when he was finished. We'll be on the lookout for her. Is your home still livable?
Barely, Mum said.
You might want to stay close to it the next couple of days, in case she comes back on her own.
The policeman removed the report from his clipboard, added it to the mountain of papers already on his desk, and then looked past to others waiting for help.
Next in line, please.
From the police station, Emmy and her mother went to the hospital, which was bursting with the injured. No one there had admitted a little girl named Julia. No one had seen a little girl who fit her description. They appealed to their local warden, Mr. Finley, whom they found making the rounds with officials whose job it was to determine whether the houses in his sector, that had been destroyed, still had victims inside them. He wearily told them to try Julia's school, on the slim chance that someone had taken her there last night to be re-evacuated out of London. But that suggestion also proved fruitless. The school was a burned-out shell. Next, they trudged to social services, They pounded on the door of the nearest children's home for orphans and crawled inside every shelter in a 2-mile radius. No one had seen the 7-year-old girl. And no one had time to stop what they were doing to help Emmy and her mother figure out where she was. No one could do more than ask the same questions everyone else was asking. Did you check the hospital? Did you contact the police? Did you search the shelters? Did you check all the wardrobes and cupboards at home? Under the stairs? In the attic? The neighbors? Everywhere they turned, they were reminded that their little woe meant nothing compared to the compounded loss of London's East End. Mum would not look at Emmy or speak to her after she had told her why she had come back to London and why she had brought Julia with her. In their search, Emmy and her mother went to each place together, but in silence. When they had exhausted all their options, they returned to the flat, hoping that Julia was waiting there for them. Sitting on the stoop, with her arms looped around, knees folded to her chest. But the front step was empty. Their neighbor to the left was covering her broken windows with pieces of plywood. When the woman, a quiet factory worker named Geraldine, saw Emmy and her mum, she paused with a hammer in hand.
"Did you find your little one?" she asked.
Mum shook her head. She went into the flat without a word.
"No one has seen her," Emmy replied. "She has to turn up,"
the woman said, but her tone conveyed her doubt. Inside, Mum was standing at the kitchen sink, looking out the broken window at the bit of dirt that was their back garden. Her hands were folded across her chest. Emmy lowered herself into a kitchen chair, grateful to be off her injured leg, but not wanting to be in the same room with Mum and the crushing weight of her anguish. She had already told Mum she was sorry, so very sorry, and there was nothing else she could say. She said it again anyway.
"I'm so sorry, Mum."
Her mother did not turn at the sound of Emmy's voice. She just stood there, looking at the dirt and the scattering of war debris that had landed in the garden.
"Mum?
I should have known something like this would happen," Mum murmured, more to the broken window than to Emmy.
"What?"
"I should have guessed that when you put you and me together, this is what comes of it." Emmy didn't know what she meant. She didn't want to know. "I sent you away with Julia when you didn't want to go, and you came back with her when you should have left her where she was," she said, her voice strangely emotionless.
"I'm sorry, Mum,"
Emmy said for the 100th time.
"I didn't know this was going to happen. I thought she'd be safe. I thought you were..."
Her voice trailed away.
"Yes, you thought I'd be coming home. To my empty house, like I do every night, because that's the life I have."
Her detached manner scared Emmy. She said nothing. Her mum turned to face her.
"Don't you want to ask me where I was last night? Don't you want to know, since it's my fault this happened?"
Emmy wanted the floor to open up beneath her and swallow her whole. She wanted to scream and scream until she had screamed all the oxygen out of the room and she could simply keel over dead in the chair.
"That's what you're thinking, isn't it? That it's my fault?" "That's not what I'm thinking," Emmy whispered. "I didn't know this would happen. I just wanted to make something of myself. I just wanted you to be proud of me."
Mum stared at Emmy for several long seconds, her arms crossed loosely over her chest.
"Is that really what you wanted? Wasn't it instead to prove to yourself that you're better than I am? You've always been ashamed of what I am. No wonder you jumped at the first chance to get the hell out of life here with me."
"That's not true," Emmy yelled.
"Of course it's true. And who can blame you? You were never meant for this. Not this."
She turned back to the window. They were quiet for a few minutes, each lost in private regrets. When she turned back around, Emmy could see that her mother had made a decision. She strode purposely past Emmy. Emmy heard her on the stairs. She got up from the kitchen chair and limped up to the second floor. Mum was in her bedroom, looking through her wardrobe. Glass crunched beneath Emmy's feet as she walked in. Mum pulled out a heather gray dress she'd come home with last spring. If she had noticed Emmy was wearing one of her dresses, Emmy couldn't tell. She said nothing.
"What are you doing?"
Emmy asked. Mum tossed the dress onto her bed, reached up to the buttons on her maid's uniform, and undid them. She stepped out of her work clothes and pulled on the dress.
"I can't do this alone. I need help."
"But we've already been to the police, and they..."
"I'm not talking about the police. They don't care about me or Julia. I'm no one to them. Just another pitiful soul they don't have the time or the means to pay attention to. I need someone who has connections."
She grabbed a hairbrush off her bureau, shook the dust from it, and ran it through her hair. Even after a night of hell and a day of torment, she still looked so beautiful.
"Where are you going?"
Emmy asked softly. Mum picked up a bottle of perfume and squeezed the ball. The room filled with a sweet scent.
"Stay here," she said. "I don't want Julie coming home to an empty house."
She moved past Emmy, who turned to follow her.
"Where are you going, Mum?"
"If the sirens go off again, go to the shelter at the corner. When they stop, get back here as quick as you can."
"Mum!"
Emmy rushed to keep up with her. Her mother was down the stairs and reaching for her handbag where she had dropped it at the front door when Emmy reached for her.
"Mum, please, wait!"
Her mother turned to face Emmy.
"Please, Mum, tell me where you're going."
Mum looked at her for a moment, studying her daughter's face, as if seeing it for the first time in a long while.
"I'm going to get help."
It made Emmy sick to think she was going to whomever she was selling her body to. She was sure that was where her mum was headed. Emmy had brought her to this moment. It was because of her that Mum's options for finding Julia had been reduced to this.
"Mum, don't go,"
Emmy pleaded. "I have to." Then, from some crazed part of her, Emmy tossed out an offer that scared her breathless the second she uttered it. Not only because it was so terrible, but because she was ready to make good on it.
"Take me with you."
I'll do whatever it is you have to do. I'll do it. This is all my fault."
Mum's features softened into a look Emmy hadn't seen since Neville first came into her life to stay. Julia was a baby, and Mum was happy then. She reached out to touch Emmy's face, cupping her fingers gently under her daughter's chin.
"No, it's not."
"Yes, it is. It is. Let me do what you have to do."
She smiled, dropped her hand, and looked away. A mirthless laugh escaped her.
"Oh, Em, you're not like me. Deep down, I've always known it. You're not like me. This is my doing. I will fix it."
When she turned back to look at Emmy, her eyes were glistening. "Find something to cover the windows."
"Mum,
stay here. Watch for your sister. Don't go outside after dark. It's not safe."
Before Emmy could say another word, her mother stepped outside into the chaos of their broken street, and she watched her walk away. A beautiful woman in a heather gray dress, with whispers of floral scent trailing after her. Chapter 21. After Mum left, Emmy busied herself with looking for something to cover the windows in the front of the flat.
Geraldine saw her poking about the ruins across the street for larger pieces of wood, and brought over her last piece of plywood. She helped Emmy cover the front window downstairs, the biggest of the three that had shattered. And she let Emmy borrow her hammer and nails, so that Emmy could cover the empty window frame in Mum's upstairs room, and the little one upstairs in the privy. Emmy attempted to return the hammer, but Geraldine asked her if she and Mum were staying that night at the flat. When Emmy nodded, she said,
"You know there's no electricity, no gas, no running water. Julia might come home. Does your mother keep a gun?"
Emmy shook her head, unable to reason why her neighbor was asking that.
"Hang on to the ammo, then."
She watched Geraldine trudge off with one suitcase, to who knew where, the rest of her worldly belongings as secure as she could make them. Back inside the flat, Emmy swept up the shards of glass, shook out all the sofa pillows, and waited for Mum. At dusk, she was still not back. Emmy found half a package of biscuits, and another of sardines, and ate them. Still, Mum was not back. She went upstairs to the room she shared with Julia, grabbed the coverlet and pillow from her bed, and took them downstairs. She arranged herself on the sofa so that she would hear if anyone came to the front door. The room quickly became inky black as the sun set, and whatever residual light that crept in through the boards over the windows disappeared. She pulled the blanket up under her chin and clutched Geraldine's hammer. Minutes later, the air raid sirens began to wail, and the drone of planes overhead rumbled outside. Emmy grabbed the blanket and hammer and headed for Thea's, pulling open the broken front door and running through the kitchen. When she flung open the back door, Emmy saw that Thea's cats lay dead on the back step, stretched out as if they had been arranged there by death itself. Emmy grimaced as she stepped over the bodies and crawled inside the Anderson shelter. Emmy yanked the door closed and scooted as far back as she could in the pitch black of the damp shelter, knocking over a box of metal items that skittered across the dirt floor. The ground beneath her knees rocked as somewhere nearby a bomb connected with its target, and a spray of dirt fell on her.
"Stop! Stop it!"
Emmy yelled, pressing her hand to her ears, while fear coursed through her veins. She was now the girl home alone while bombs rained down all around.
"Julia."
Emmy called for her sister. She called for Mum. She could do nothing but cover herself with a blanket and clutch the hammer as the bombs fell. Emmy would learn that this second night was worse than the first. 400 people would be killed, and more than 700 injured. Warehouses along the Thames were again easy targets, and buildings that had been afire on Saturday night were burning again. Hundreds of fires would join together to become one. And all the while, Emmy huddled in Thea's bomb shelter, alone and afraid. She didn't know when she fell asleep. She only knew that when she awoke, she heard the far-off sounds of emergency vehicles. She emerged from the shelter to a fog of smoke and ash and mist. Her row of flats was still standing, but the unit on the end was now minus a roof and a second story. Emmy picked her way back to the flat, calling for Mum, calling for Julia. But the street, the flat, all that she knew, were empty of people and silent. Inside she used the toilet, its water soured and stinking, since it had been used but not flushed in 2 days. The food in the fridge, the little there was, stank as well. She found a swallow of brandy in the cupboard above the fridge, which she drank because there was nothing else. Then she opened a tin of beans and ate them cold with a spoon. Sometime later, Emmy saw through a slit in the plywood a man approaching the flat. The warden, perhaps? Emmy could not let him see her. He would insist she leave, and that was something Emmy could not do. She had not locked the front door. Before she could turn the latch, she heard him knock. Emmy sprang to the kitchen and let herself out the back door into the debris-littered garden, where she concealed herself as best she could along the wall. She still held the hammer. Emmy heard the man inside the house.
"Anyone here? Annie, are you here?"
Emmy stood still against the wall. The voice didn't belong to Mr. Findlay. She didn't recognize the voice at all. Still, he would only be able to see her if he came into the garden, and surely there was no reason for him to do that. He called for Mum again, and then he left. Emmy waited until she could see him over the garden wall, walking away. He wore a nice hat and a wool coat. Should she have revealed herself? She wasn't sure. She didn't know him. What did he want with her mother? Emmy watched the man until he was no longer in sight. Then she went back inside and waited. Mum did not come back. Emmy read Julia's book of fairy tales. She slept. She ate another can of cold beans. She watched the fires burning across town from the back garden. When darkness began to fall, Emmy realized it was Monday. Mr. Dabney had expected her at his townhouse at 4 o'clock that afternoon, with her mother and the bride's box in tow. He and his sweet wife were leaving for Edinburgh tomorrow, and she was to go with them, she and her bride's box, because she was going to be Graham Dabney's apprentice. It was now after 7, and the sirens began to wail. Once again, Emmy grabbed the hammer and her blanket and ran to Thea's Anderson shelter. In that hellish cocoon, Emmy did not know that fires were burning all around St. Paul's, and buildings were ablaze on both sides of Ludgate Hill. A women's hospital was hit, as was a school being used to shelter homeless families. More than 400 people were killed, and more than 1,000 injured, on the second night that she huddled in Thea's shelter, the third night of the Blitz. There were a few tins of canned milk inside the shelter, which she drank, and a package of digestive biscuits, which she ate. She fell asleep when exhaustion overcame her, to the rumblings of explosions that filled her dreams with terror. In the morning, as the East End continued to burn, Emmy let herself back inside Thea's flat, hardly noticing the dead cats as she stepped over them. She needed food and water. Thea had emptied her kitchen of food in preparation for evacuating with her mother to Wales, but Emmy found a few jars of preserves, canned meat, and other items that would not spoil in their absence. She grabbed a market basket from Thea's kitchen and filled it with all the food she had left, even the cat's food. She took the basket and her hammer back to the flat to wait for Mum, but she did not come. And Julia did not return home. Rain began to fall in the late afternoon, a weeping, mournful downpour. Extending into the early evening hours, it should have kept the Luftwaffe from continuing its assault. But no. The Luftwaffe made full use of the cloud cover. Bombers pounded the city once again, and Emmy spent another night in Thea's shelter. On Wednesday, with no sign of Mum or Julia, Emmy hid the basket of food in her wardrobe upstairs and ventured out to look for them. She went back to the places Mum and she had been before. She also went to the shelters where the homeless were gathering. No one at the hospital had seen Julia, and there was no record of either Julia or Mum having been admitted. Emmy returned to the police station, which was as chaotically busy as it had been 3 days before. A different policeman was on duty, and she had to explain all over again how Julia came to be missing. "Where's your mother right now?" this new policeman said, looking past Emmy. Emmy was a child, and he didn't have time for children. "She's out looking for my sister." It wasn't exactly a lie. It was obvious he was perturbed that Emmy was at the station alone without Mum. "Look, I've heard nothing of a young girl turning up. Have your Mum check with all the neighbours, and the Charles' friends, and..." Emmy cut him off. "We don't have any more neighbours. Our street has been bombed.
Everyone has left. That is what I have been telling you. She went missing the first night of the bombing.
He frowned at the interruption.
You bring your mum here, and I will make out an official report.
We already did that,
Emmy yelled.
On Sunday. This is Wednesday. She's been missing for 4 days.
The policeman wagged a finger at Emmy.
Do you think you're the only soul in London with a tale of woe today? Do you know how many people are dead or missing? You tell your mum to come next time. I'm done with you.
He turned from Emmy to help someone else. She stood there, stunned, unable to believe no one could help her. An older woman sitting on a bench, and looking as though she had been waiting a long time, crooked a finger, beckoning Emmy to approach her.
I heard what you said to the policeman, and I'm very sorry your little sister is missing, she said. I hate to be the one to tell you this, but you and your mum should check the casualty listings at one of the incident inquiry points.
Emmy had no idea what she was talking about.
The what?
She reached for Emmy's arm and squeezed it gently.
They have listings, my dear. The names of those who've been killed. They have a list.
Emmy felt the blood drain from her face.
I don't know what you're saying.
But she did. She did know what she was saying. The woman released her hold and patted Emmy's arm.
Tell your mum to check at the nearest incident inquiry point, love. There's an IIP just around the corner from the police station here. Tell your mum to check with them.
The woman withdrew her hand and her attention. She turned from Emmy to stare at the queue of people waiting their turn for help, allowing Emmy a sliver of privacy to take in the idea that Julia's body might be lying in a morgue somewhere, waiting for a family member to claim her remains. Emmy left the station numb with fear and dread. Somehow, she put one foot in front of the other and walked to the IIP office, as the woman had called it. Emmy stepped inside and fell in with the crowds of people seeking information. Her mind seemed to drift into that state between sleep and wakefulness as she waited her turn. Others ahead of her also wanted to see the lists. New copies of the latest reports of the dead were laid out on the counter by a green-uniformed matron of the Women's Volunteer Service. Those on an errand like no other moved forward to peer at them. The man ahead of Emmy looked and turned away, relief evident in his face. Emmy bent over to look, her gaze traveling over the letters of the alphabet, past the A's, the B's, the C's, and then the D's. And then she saw it. Downtree. Emmy's heart slammed against her chest. Downtree. And then she saw the name following it, separated from Downtree with a tiny, gentle comma. Anne Louise. It wasn't Julia's name listed on the roll call of the dead. It was Mum's. Chapter 22. Emmy had never been to a morgue before, makeshift or otherwise. The sheet-covered bodies lay on the school cafeteria floor, where only 6 months earlier, children had eaten sausages and peas at sturdy wooden tables. The fallen were arranged in even rows, each one with a cardboard label affixed to the chest, identifying them by name, if it was known, and where they had been killed. Several officials moved about the rows, escorting next of kin to the draped body of the family member they'd been looking for, lifting a corner of the covering, and revealing just half the face. All that a mother or brother, or son or grandparent needed to see, to identify and claim their beloved. Emmy would not be able to recall every step to the school-turned morgue, or how she managed to remember the directions after she was told how far she needed to walk to claim her mother's body. She did remember being asked how old she was, when at last her voice returned, and she whispered to the volunteer at the IIP
that Mum's name was among those on the list of the dead. The first lie came off her lips as easy as air out of a burst balloon. To have said she was 15 and orphaned was to have sentenced herself to a children's home or worse. A social services worker would have been summoned. Emmy would have been escorted away. She wouldn't have been able to return to the flat. She wouldn't have been able to keep looking for Julia, whose name was not on the list. Not on the list. Emmy was all Julia had. She had to stay on her own. She had to. 18, Emmy had said. And where was her father? The second lie came just as effortlessly. Recovering in hospital. We got separated Sunday night. Kind condolences were offered to Emmy, but she did not want the woman's sympathy. She wanted nothing from her that would give weight and substance to yet another grief. Emmy was tired of weight and substance. Tired of fear, of anguish, of hunger, of thirst, of despair. She wanted to feel nothing. It had taken supreme effort not to press her hand to the woman's mouth and tell her to shut up about the terrible loss of her mother. "Where is she?" Emmy had said, and the woman told her how to find the temporary morgue that had been set up near Holborn Station for unclaimed dead. Every step had seemed like the ticking off of the days and weeks and months the war was taking from her. With one word, she allowed her 16th and 17th years to be swallowed whole by the enemy, taken as swiftly and surely as the war had stolen everything else that was hers. This was all she had been aware of as she strode forward. She could be a child no longer. Emmy had to be done with immature worries and juvenile hopes. Orphan was a word to describe a child without parents. Emmy was not a child. She was Julia's only living hope, and as such, her little sister's guardian. Julia was Emmy's sole concern. She would tell whatever lie she must to find her sister. Mum would want only one thing from Emmy now, to find Julia. When Emmy arrived at the temporary morgue, she was 18. She felt 18. There would be no looking back. She approached a haggard-looking city official with a clipboard, who seemed to be in charge of receiving callers to the morgue. He looked as though he hadn't slept in days.
"I've come about my mother,"
Emmy said, surprising herself with how grown up she sounded.
"Her name is Annie Downtree. Anne Louise Downtree. I was told I would find her body here."
The man looked at his clipboard.
"Are you the next of kin?"
His voice sounded as tired as his body looked. "I'm her only kin." He looked up to study Emmy's face, wondering perhaps how old she was. But Emmy knew she no longer looked like a child. "My father passed away when I was young." Again, the lie flew off Emmy's tongue with hardly a moment's thought.
"I'm so sorry for you, lass. Truly I am."
Emmy did not want his sympathy.
"Where is she?"
Again he consulted his clipboard, and then he checked a ledger on a nearby desk. When he looked up, he shook his head.
"We aren't able to keep the unclaimed bodies more than a few days. We always make what inquiries we can." "I am so sorry."
An odd sensation rippled through Emmy.
Fear?
Emptiness?
Dread?
"What did you do with her?" she said, restraining emotion thickening her words. He consulted his clipboard yet again. When he looked up, he rubbed his chin with his hand, the gesture of one about to say something he was afraid to say.
"She was very proper, I can tell you that, in Tower Hamlets, just this morning."
Emmy needed a moment to understand what the man was telling her. Mum had been buried already. She was buried. Buried.
"What is Tower Hamlets?"
"It's the public cemetery, miss. Not far from Charing Cross. They were all given proper burials."
She swallowed a lingering sensation of loss and fear. They? There were others what no one came for, and who had no kin near as we could tell. They were buried proper, a vicar and everything.
A vicar? Emmy echoed.
Yes.
Emmy started to teeter, and she steadied herself against the wall.
Miss? He said. Where was she found?
The man checked the ledger, a different page this time.
In the basement of the Sharrington Crescent Hotel. The place took a direct hit, I'm afraid. The upper floors collapsed into the basement to here. No one sheltering in the basement survived. I'm sorry.
A hotel.
She was at a hotel.
Where is this place? Emmy said evenly.
I'm sure it was quick, miss. I'm sure she didn't suffer.
He could be sure of nothing. And he and Emmy both knew it.
Where is it?
Near Covent Garden, I think. And there were others.
Others?
He blinked wide-eyed.
Others in the basement. Was she with someone?
He blinked again.
Oh, aye. There were other victims, I hear. A dozen or so.
And they all came here? The man was trying to piece together why Emmy was asking so many questions. He stared at her.
No, not all.
Just the ones no one came for. Emmy finished for him. He half nodded, embarrassed for her, possibly.
We have what she was found with, he said. Her handbag and such. Those haven't been stored away yet. Hold on.
He disappeared into the kitchen, and Emmy heard him speaking to a woman. The man told her whose effects Emmy was after, and the woman asked who wanted them.
It's the deceased's daughter.
Daughter?
The woman sounded surprised. Emmy's pulse quickened as the woman appeared in the doorway. Her brow furrowed.
Are you Anne Downtree's daughter?
The woman asked as she approached Emmy. Emmy felt a pulsing instinct to run.
I am.
She swallowed the rising alarm.
Your foster mother already got the telegram and brought you here.
A second ripple of fear coursed through her.
Yes.
The woman looked past Emmy to the door she'd come through.
We weren't told you'd be coming today.
I'm sorry to tell you that I could not have released your mother's body to your foster mother, even if I had wanted to.
Is that what she was thinking? Is she outside waiting for you?
Emmy had to get away. But she had to pretend as if she didn't.
She is,
Emmy said slowly. The woman frowned as if she'd been insulted.
And sent you in here alone? Of all the...
She slammed the ledger shut and began to stride toward the door. Emmy moved toward the woman, blocking her path.
Please, I asked to come in alone. I wanted to see her on my own. My foster mother wanted to come in with me, but I begged her not to.
The woman's disdain melted into something more like compassion.
She's waiting for me at the chemist,
Emmy continued.
My little sister has... She has asthma.
We needed medicine.
I'll go get her.
Emmy turned before either one could offer to accompany her. She strode toward the door as unhurriedly as she dared, without Mum's handbag or whatever else she had on her when her body was found. As soon as she was outside and around the corner, Emmy ran as fast as her legs could carry her. Tears crept to the corners of her eyes as she sprinted down the street, but Emmy savagely rubbed them away. After several blocks, and when her lungs were burning, she slowed to a walk, looking behind to make sure no one was coming after her. So Charlotte had been sent a telegram that Mum had died. Would they come looking for her? Emmy wasn't sure. Would the woman at the morgue assume that once Emmy told her foster mother that Mum had already been buried, They would opt for the first train out of hellish London.
She would, wouldn't she?
Even so, Emmy could not continue to stay at the flat. Not now that she had been seen. Besides, there was no running water, electricity, gas, or food. She had to make other arrangements. But what? Emmy had passed homeless shelters on the way back to Whitechapel, but whenever she had neared one of them, she smelled the fetid odor of unwashed bodies and makeshift latrines. She had no desire to stay in one. She could not go back to Mrs. Billingsley's. The widow and her staff all knew how old Emmy was. They would contact social services. Perhaps, though, Mrs. Billingsley could be persuaded to help her find Julia, if Emmy begged her. The woman had money. Apparently Mum had believed money was needed to do what the police could not or would not. But would Mrs. Billingsley do that? Emmy could not chance it. She could go to no one that she knew, no classmate from school, or even a classmate's family. She had to be 18-year-old Emmeline, a woman who did not yet exist in the eyes of anyone who knew her. But where else could she go? And then Emmy thought of Mrs. Crofton. Could Emmy convince her to let her stay with her? Emmy had missed the opportunity to become Graham's apprentice. But perhaps Mrs. Crofton would allow Emmy to stay with her while Emmy looked for Julia. Emmy would promise her that when she found her sister, she would return to Charlotte's, and she and Julia would stay in Stowe for the remainder of the war, as they were supposed to have done. Yes, Emmy would do that. She would again have her bride's box. She would find some way to regain the opportunity she had lost. Emmy would bring Julia with her back to London when the war ended. Perhaps Mrs. Crofton would allow her and Julia to board with her. Mrs. Crofton had had a daughter once, and she was fond of Emmy because of that. Emmy could tell that she was. She could pay for their room and board by working at the shop. And at night she would work on her gowns. Perhaps after the war, Mr. Dabney would give Emmy another chance. Emmy could still find a way to make Mum proud of her. Surely God allowed a dead mother glances from heaven at the children she had been torn from. Yes. But Emmy didn't know where Mrs. Crofton lived. Hoping the shop had not been bombed, she decided to make her way to Primrose Bridal. She still had the back door key. She would wait for Mrs. Crofton there, or poke about her desk, looking for the woman's home address. Surely Mrs. Crofton would understand the need to do such a bold thing. Emmy quickened her steps, impatient to take what she needed out of the flat and get to the bridal shop. She arrived back home as the sun dipped low in the sky. Emmy pulled a travel bag from Mum's wardrobe and added to it the contents of her mother's top bureau drawer, which included her stockings, a nightgown, a felt-lined jewelry box, and a few trinkets. She also stuffed inside three of her mother's dresses, a pair of her slacks, gloves, and a pair of heeled shoes. Next, Emmy went into her old bedroom and took the remaining undergarments she had left behind, a few of Julia's clothes, so that when she found her sister, she'd have clean clothes to wear. Back downstairs, Emmy grabbed her satchel and tossed what was left of Thea's food stores inside, and the hammer, and ran out of the flat and down the deserted street. The sun was nearly gone from the horizon. Emmy doubled her speed, running haphazardly with her awkward load.
"Let it be standing,"
Emmy whispered to the heavens.
"Let Primrose still be there."
She covered the four blocks to the shop in less than 10 minutes, dodging debris and collecting stairs all along the way. She reached the street, and her heart plummeted to her knees. The building on the corner of the street was a smoking hulk. But Primrose, four buildings down on the opposite side, still stood among the ruins. Chapter 23. Emmy led herself into the bridal shop by its back door, certain that Mrs. Crofton wasn't there, and yet she called for her as she stepped into the shadows. She locked the door behind her and crept from the back entrance to the alterations room where she had first sewn a hem for Mrs. Crofton. Here, Mrs. Crofton had installed a blackout curtain for nights when she stayed late after business hours. Emmy lowered her belongings to the floor and reached up to the little window that overlooked the alley. She pulled the curtain down, securing it to the hooks Mrs. Crofton had nailed into the plaster. Emmy switched on the small table lamp by the sewing machine, grateful that the electricity on this side of the street had not been affected. A halo of sallow light fell about the tiny room. It was just enough brightness to see her way around, but not enough to be detected by patrolling wardens and fire watchers outside. Emmy plugged in Mrs. Crofton's hot plate, filled the tea kettle, and for the first time since she had sat in Mr. Dabney's elegant sitting room, a lifetime ago, she drank hot tea from a dainty, beautiful cup. Along with the tea, Emmy ate two slices of stale bread that she had taken from Thea's kitchen, spread with marmalade. In her rush to be away from the flat, she had not considered that she might need a blanket and a pillow this night. It was too dark now to rummage around Mrs. Crofton's desk for her home address. Emmy would have to sleep at Primrose. She stripped down to her underwear, and with water from the sink in the loo, she used a scrap of fabric from the alterations dustbin to wash the grit, dirt, and ash from her body. Then she stuck her head under the tap and washed her hair, repulsed by the swirls of dirty suds that accumulated at the drain as she massaged her scalp. Emmy used a hand towel to dry off, and then slipped on a pair of Mum's slacks and a blouse to serve as pajamas. As she started to comb out the tangles with the brush she'd grabbed from Mum's bedroom, she noticed it still held strands of her mother's hair in the bristles. She pulled the brush away from her head. As she gazed at the mingled strands, hers and Mum's, a wave of grief swept over her. For hours, Emmy had kept the loss of her mother at a distance, refusing to acknowledge that Mum was dead. In her drastic measures to be able to keep searching for Julia, Emmy had not allowed herself to shed a tear for Mum. Not one. But now, as she stood in the back room of the bridal shop, wearing Mum's clothes and holding her mother's hairbrush, the full weight of her loss came crashing in. Emmy sank to her knees, clutching the brush to her chest. The bristles pricked her skin like nettles through the thin fabric of her mother's blouse. The tears began to fall, rivers of them, as Emmy sat back on her bent knees. "Mum," Emmy murmured, as she thought of her mother's hand on her cheek, and the last word she had said to her, the last word she would ever hear her say, floated into Emmy's mind. "Stay here and watch for your sister. Don't go outside after dark. It's not safe." With those parting words, Emmy had suddenly been flung into an unfamiliar world, falling apart all around her. She was alone in the very place where, only a few months ago, hope had been breathed into her dreams. Those dreams seemed thin as vapor now, spun by a different girl, someone Emmy barely recognized. "Mum. Mum." Emmy's voice was hoarse as she pushed it past the anguish in her throat. She raised her hand to wipe away tears and caught the faintest whiff of Mum's perfume on the sleeve of the blouse. Emmy folded herself to the floor and laid her head on the travel bag, clutching the hairbrush to her body, just as the night before she had clutched the hammer. As she lay on the tiles, she began to shiver, and she screwed her eyes shut to take herself back to Brighton Beach, to that long-ago sultry weekend when Neville was still in Mum's life. The sand had been warm between Emmy's toes, and a brilliant sun had been shining down on the water, making the surface of the sea look wired with tiny little flames. The white surf hitting the shore bubbled like bridal lace, and Mum had been standing by Emmy as she dug her toes into the sand. They had been watching Neville and Julia play in the waves, and Mum had reached down and laid a hand on her shoulder. Emmy had been reminded then of how it had been before Julia was born, when it was just she and Mum. Emmy had been flooded with a memory of her and Mum splashing in a London fountain, and Mum stroking Emmy's hair and telling her someday she'd have everything she wanted. And then Julia had squealed for Emmy to help her, as